Hello, everybody, and welcome to the March 1st Pony Sync Call. Let's get going. We were just talking about, before the call started, we were talking about error handling in Pony because of the RFC on type-directed error handling. I can't remember the number of that. I'll just find it real quick here. It's stateful exceptions number 76. And particularly, we're talking about Joe Duffy's blog about the Midori project and the fact that they draw a distinction between errors that are recoverable and those that are not, shouldn't ever be recoverable, and represent core programming errors, and your program simply should not continue. And that there are branches, like in map.pony in insert, there's an unreachable branch, and it makes the function partial when it otherwise wouldn't have to be partial. And do we want to have the ability to annotate a branch as unreachable, and therefore it doesn't contribute to the type of that control structure? So insert wouldn't have to be partial. But on the other hand, if there really was an error in map.pony, it would crash your program. And Joe quite rightly points out, when should a library have permission to crash my program? Because that's a real issue. Anyway, that's what we were talking about just before the call.
Yeah, it seems like any sort of system of trying to, I don't know, like shrink wrap a library and make it so that, you know, put it in a safe bubble where you try to catch the unreachable clause sort of defeats the purpose of it just being a totally unreachable branch.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I don't necessarily want to just pull in a dependency and find that especially with, you know, with no API changes visible from like the function signatures, suddenly this has the possibility of crashing the rest of my program if they made a programming error in their library. I think it's the kind of thing that definitely seems like it could be really useful on an application level. I mean, for example, the Pony compiler is an application that uses asserts, you know, throughout.
Yeah.
You know, throughout it to say this is something that should never ever happen, and if it does happen, then it's a bug and there's no way we can possibly continue with the program.
Right.
And yeah, we've found in practice those happen all the time.
Yeah. Indeed. Yeah. So just to mix in with that, the other thing that they talked about was making control flow visible at the call site in much the way we make privacy visible at the call site. And their way of doing it was that anything that you called that could raise an error, because much like Pony, they have checked exceptions everywhere, you had to invoke using the try keyword. You could not call it except using the try keyword. And not in a try expression, but rather that particular invocation had to have the try keyword on it. And I thought, well, that sounds really heavyweight. I wouldn't want that. And literally later that day, I was going through the persistent map implementation going, hey, why is this particular call partial? And it took more spelunking than I expected to figure out which call could raise an error.
Yeah, actually, not to toot my own horn a little, I feel like this is a concern that I raised a while ago. With regard to, I was proposing that we change the meaning of a then clause in a try block, such that anytime you wanted to do a partial call, the best pattern for doing it would be try, you know, then operation that could fail, and possibly sets like a local variable.
Yeah.
And then you use then to, you know, and the rest of the block from then to end is not it wouldn't rescue any exceptions. It wouldn't catch any errors from any calls in there, and they would have to be, you know, like
individually.
If the function was not partial, then there could be no errorable calls in that then block. But it could have, it could do things that depended on a value that you grabbed and set into a local variable in your try clause.
Right. Right.
And that I think something like that, and this was kind of I was citing the same concern that you end up with like creating a significant chunk of statements that all get lumped in this try block, and it's not immediately clear what's the risky part and yep. where it could bail out. And if you had as a user the ability to say it's not going to bail out anywhere here, and if for some reason the library changes and now this call is partial, I would get a compiler error rather than now it only has another place to bail out.
Yeah, yeah. So I think that all fits in exactly with the kind of thinking that we're currently doing. I'm still concerned, much as I was then, about the try-then pattern encouraging everybody to simply then throw everything into the try block of that expression and even, mm-hmm. and ignore the then side. So one of the things that I thought about, and this is I'm not saying let's do this, I'm saying what in the heck would that look like? What if partial invocation, what if the question mark was also part of the call site?
Yeah, I was just thinking the same thing.
So, for example,
you had to annotate every recall that could error.
Yeah, just by putting a question mark after the either after closing your parentheses or before starting your parentheses to before starting is a bit lispy in a nice way. I like Lisp. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, that seems like it's a better idea than mine.
Is it? I don't know. I'm not totally sure about that. I think it's worth discussing. I'm not going to jump in there and say it's necessarily a better idea, but we should.
Right. I mean, but I think, you know, it solves, well, I guess what I should say is that, it solves the set of problems I was concerned about and oriented my solution toward, and it also solves additional problems that you mentioned of,
yeah.
Still that it's sort of, and I think this is something that maybe, Andy raised, back in the day when we were first discussing this, is that it's like an optional, thing that is dependent on if the user was conscientious enough to minimize the amount of stuff in their try clause.
Right.
And if they didn't care about that or chose not to, then
you got no benefit from it.
Yeah, you don't get the benefit.
Yeah.
And I don't see that as a good enough reason not to do something like this, but I do see it as a good reason to look for other solutions like the one that you mentioned. I think that the one that you mentioned is a good one and, you know, fairly lightweight in terms of syntax. You're just adding an extra character onto those calls. It shouldn't be too burdensome.
And we could,
from the point of view of typist, it definitely makes it more readable. So
right, exactly. We could even consider something a little bit more invasive, which would be in the signature to move the question mark to between the method name and the parameters, if that was the position that we used it at the call site.
Yeah. I'm still not necessarily sold on either way of whether it should be between the name and the parentheses or following the parentheses.
Right.
A part of me thinks that following the parentheses makes the most sense, but that could just be partially
because nicely done.
That's where it exists in the function signature. So.
Well, right. That's what I was thinking. I was thinking that there seems like there's some kind of alignment there. But yeah, so there you go.
So yeah, that would be interesting if we just kind of made the question mark part of the identifier for the method. Although I guess, I don't know, that It might confuse some people who are coming from a background of languages that let you put a question mark in your method name. That it's typically like a signifier that method will return a Boolean.
That's true.
Question, but I don't know.
Like, I think Elixir does that.
Does Elixir use trailing question marks?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm not sure their convention there, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, it's something that is done in Ruby as well. It's an allowed part of the end of your method name if you choose to use it. And then there's just sort of community convention around using. It's like answering a question with a true or false value. I mean, that it still may not be totally inappropriate. It's just something worth mentioning that I don't know if that would be confusing or actually familiar for those people. I mean, it is a slightly different concept, but it is, like you said, we've got the privacy versus publicness of the method as right. part of the name as the underscore. So
I'm just looking at the Elixir conventions, and interestingly, a lot of them are quite similar to Pony in that, like, a leading underscore for a function name in a module is not imported when you import that module. It's private. They use a trailing bang for a function or macro that can raise an exception, and a trailing question mark for a Boolean method.
Yeah, so, and I think the trailing bang is more to tell you, like, they when they provide that, there's usually like two versions of a function. One that returns a return value that has like an error code as part of the tuple, they have like you do a pattern match on the result to determine if there was an error, and then the bang method is sort of the bang function is sort of like I'm confident in this and I'm fine if it unwinds my stack, sort of thing, or I'm just trying to do like a quick like one off in a test where you know if. I mean, typically they prefer the pattern matching for the error handling,
right?
But you use the bang function when you're like confident about it and just want to assert that I assert that this will work,
right? Interesting. They also overload the bang for unhygienic macros, which yeah. seems unfortunate. But
I think it's like it's like a general sign for danger.
Yeah. They use
which is not necessarily what we want to convey. I think you know,
right.
talk about like partiality and you know and raising an error in Pony is the preferred. I think that the bang function in Elixir is like you're doing something that's kind of an anti-pattern and not preferred. But it, you know if you know why you're doing it, you can do it. But
yeah.
It's not really conveying the same thing.
Yeah. They also use an is prefix, and they talk about something that is clearly an Elixir thing that I don't understand, which is it's for a Boolean check that is allowed in a guard clause, but I'm confused why a guard clause couldn't have an arbitrary Boolean check. But, oh well, something I don't understand there. Because a guard clause is just like the if clause, which is literally a guard clause on pony pattern matching, right? It does the same.
I would say this is just a Ruby cultural thing. I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, well, in terms of like what's allowed on a guard clause, I don't remember the exact constrictions on it, but they've got it as part of their like function dispatch to where you can attach the guard clause to the function signature, and it'll choose a different version of the function to be dispatched to based on.
Oh, for pseudo type based dispatch. That makes sense.
Okay. Yeah. It's usually used for types. It can be used for a couple other, you know, things where you want to control, but yeah, it's yeah.
Okay, cool.
A little bit like what we're talking about in the other RFC I guess that RFC already passed the if type,
right.
Ending method signature.
Yeah, for specialization.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. Yeah, so there you go. I just wanted to talk a little bit about that, those possible error handling things. And yeah, I don't know if I want to jump in and do an RFC for question mark at call site, but maybe we could think about it and just, I don't know, see what you guys think, see what people think in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'm inclined to say you should go ahead and jump in and do an RFC for it as a means of facilitating that conversation. But
cool. Do you want to write one up?
Yeah, I can add it to my to-do list.
Okay, cool. Awesome. I suppose, on that note, we should consider talking about some of these other RFCs. How about number 80? Which is Carl's command line interface draft.
To be honest, I haven't had a chance to look through the implementation that he linked to in any kind of depth.
The implementation is fine. I looked through it. It's nice. I think this stuff that we're going over on exactly how we put these things together is good. And particularly the one that you brought up about runtime stuff, whereas if it was a flag spec dot F64 constructor, then the default would have to be an F64.
Right.
And then it could set itself to be F64 type internally.
Yep.
But other than that, this is looking pretty darn good.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to look more about the, you know, I might ask him to see if he can do some of this, just since the actual API of using the library isn't really detailed in the RFC. It's just sort of go here and look at my implementation. So I haven't looked at that in any detail yet, but it would be nice if some of that just were in the RFC as kind of, if somebody was looking back on it and saying, you know, what exactly was proposed, then yeah.
Right. Yeah. Okay, cool. Yeah. It's funny. So actually, mix in there is a comment I left about array syntax. Because I accidentally used an array syntax I've been fiddling with to give an example. And Carl was like, what the hell have you done there? But I thought I might just mention it. Does it seem crazy?
Yeah, no, I like it. A part of me wishes that they were still commas, but they were optional when on separate lines. They were like the parser was able to like switch back and forth between context. But the other part of me says, and that's just from, I guess, not wanting to deviate too much from how other arrays in other languages are done, but part of me says it is somewhat more consistent sort of internally with Pony to
right.
The expression separated by semicolons like all other groups of expressions are. One thing I wanted to ask about that was, is that the kind of thing where how arbitrary would the expressions be able to be, or no more arbitrary than they are now?
Less arbitrary than they are now, in that right now they're sequences, so you can actually write a complete sequence. However, you could still do that, of course. You would just have to put it in parentheses.
Right. Yeah. I guess in my head I was thinking a little bit about things like being able to put an if clause in there, but that when I thought through it a little bit more, that wouldn't be a very consistent way to do something like, conditionally have different lengths for the array and different elements in them, because your if would have to return some kind of value and it would count as an expression, right? So right. That original thing that popped into my head is sort of not good.
On the other hand, that brings up the concept of a comprehension syntax. And a comprehension syntax is possibly quite a good thing indeed, where we say, we're going to build an array of X where X is something, right? Comprehension syntaxes are... Well, actually, before I go into that, I should say that the semicolon and expression syntax is actually used in other languages. It's used in most ML-based languages.
Okay.
Including OCaml and F-sharp and possibly Haskell. I apologize.
Yeah, I believe I've seen this in Haskell.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, but I get myself confused on Haskell syntax, I'm sad to say. That's my failing, not Haskell's failing. Yeah, so this isn't weird from the functional language point of view, and Pony is under the hood a functional language, much as I tell everyone it's object-oriented. I'm not sure it's a huge deviation. It's just moving from one background for it to the other. But anyway, back to comprehensions. No one's really asked for them, and yet they're cool. And they do let you do things like variable length array literals by having a comprehension where you have your clause that's generating methods. So the Pony approach generally has been, why don't you write an object for that? Like when people talk about generators, hey, that's fine. Why don't you write an object for that? It's not, you know, it's pretty straightforward. But maybe comprehension syntax is worth having on its own. I don't know.
Yeah, I'd be interested to see the thing, you know, kind of flesh out for that.
Okay. I'll think about that a little bit because it's something that I've sort of been thinking about. Comprehensions come from set builder notation in mathematics, by the way, in case anyone is interested in that sort of thing. All right, cool. Coolio dulio. How about number 81? Allows you for more promise methods? I like this one quite a bit. I think you're right that it's a little bit the join, which actually join is based on all, which is really good. And it works on an array, right? And yeah, the tag is a little bit funny because it says, well, am I one of the things that should be? But on we couldn't use a constructor, and so should we use a primitive? This comes back to Joe brought up static methods on types some time ago. But then another possibility. So select. I'm sort of interested in how select works. Like add is pretty straightforward because it creates a nice tuple type. But select returns one of the types and the promise of the other.
Yep.
That's quite interesting. Okay, cool.
I've actually taken that from, I believe the, it's one of the libraries from Rust that does this sort of thing.
Nice. Yeah, there are a lot of good promise libraries out there to learn from right now. I think it's basically the awesome how much people are putting into this, given that they languished for 15 years, and then all of a sudden, this is brilliant. There's so much to learn from, which is great. So what I like about select in this context is we are using the promise that we're calling select on. We could do join, which says join the promise that we're calling it on with all of the promises in some, actually it wouldn't even have to be an array there. We could pass in a read sequence of promises.
Yeah.
then build up a promise over a vow, or if that makes any sense.
It does.
So then it would be join me with these. possibly even an iterator over promises.
I don't think you can. One of the issues with doing an iterator is that iterator, it would have to be like ISO-ized, right?
Well, not really, because it's fun tags. So you would read them out in advance before you built the thing that you actually passed in the behavior.
Right. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Fun tag, not B. You're right.
That's
so it could be an iterator. Yep.
Yeah. That's that cute fun tag trick that Promise uses all the hell over the place.
We should probably write up a pony pattern about that at some point. And I've used it a little bit in my libraries too. Like sometimes you want to do some processing on the arguments before shipping them off to the actual behavior.
Yeah.
And fun tag is kind of a seamless way to do that.
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, if it has to be a fun tag and it can't be, say, you know, static method on the type, then it does make more sense to make the receiver be part of the result. It kind of sucks, you know?
Yeah.
That you're passing in, you know, you got your receiver plus an array length of 8 or whatever, and then you get a promise on over an array length of 9. I don't know.
I think my thinking is, what if that's an iterator, and does that then make more sense?
It's probably better, honestly.
Because my thinking is that you already have a bunch of promises. So you would have to create the iterator from something.
Right, but if you had an array, you would just, if in this particular case, you would just take that array and call it on array.values.
Yeah, but then you have this other one that you have to call, like you have to have another promise that you would call this on. So you would either have to take one of those promises,
uh-huh,
and then use join with like the rest of the promises or something else.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you would probably start off by invoking, like, if you were just given an iterator, right, that has all the promises you want to deal with, you can invoke next to get the first item, and your remaining, you know, your iterator would then contain all of the rest of the items except for the first item, so that at least gives you a pattern. If you're given an array, you can use it with this method without reallocating the array. Like, let's say you had thousands of promises, and you know, you didn't want to reallocate another 1,000 promise array just for, or I guess, a 999 promise array. You could probably use slice to do it anyway. But anyway, using an iterator, I guess, is more general and allows you to do that case where you could just call next to get the first one, and then your iterator is ready to go in that argument.
Yeah.
So I do think, anywhere you have an array, obviously you can get an iterator from it. So being able to take a generic iterator is probably better from just being able to do more things with the same call.
Yeah. I think possibly, maybe, there's another thing here, which is that promises are unique by identity. And if you had an iterator of 1,000 instances of 1,000 references to the same promise, what would you expect to happen when it was fulfilled?
Oh, dear.
Well, it's all shareable, right?
Yeah.
So, like, as in your A type is constrained on share. So, I would expect to get an array with the same value repeated that many times, right?
Interesting. The other option is that you would say you would get one. And that it's implicitly a set.
Are there cases where you would need to rely on that behavior?
I don't know. So what have we thought about it in the context of add and select? What if you add a promise to itself? There, you only have one choice, which is to do what you said, not what I said, which is to return the same value in a tuple with itself.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so it seems it would be more consistent.
To not.
If that's your only choice on add, then it would be more consistent to do that same thing to join.
Right. Or similarly, select with yourself, which is ridiculous, but go ahead, right? Like, it's not semantically problematic. It's merely ridiculous. Which, when fulfilled, would give you the value and itself back again, which, you know, who knows? What do I know? Maybe that's useful. Okay, that makes me think you're right, that it has to be, if you have 1,000 of them, you would get 1,000. Is that?
Yeah, I mean, you just have to trust the user to do some sort of, you know, uniquing operation
if they
on the array first if they wanted to.
Right. They may not need to because they have some way that they're putting it together where it doesn't matter. Or they may be keeping a set anyway, and then it doesn't matter. Sets
yeah, but yeah, if they're keeping a set, that brings us back to probably wanting to accept an iterator instead of an array, right? Because if they're keeping a set, they right. could just pass the iterator from that set rather than an iterator from the array.
Good point. Yep.
Or sorry, rather than creating an array from the set and then passing the iterator to that.
Right. Whereas for any arbitrary container, if we take an iterator and we want to join over those promises, we're basically good.
So, Theo, does that make sense that or do you agree that we would want it to accept an iterator to be more general, or is there still concerns you'd have about that?
That seems to be the best option at this point.
So then, I'm such a pain in the ass, but I think we should still think about Theo's question about should this be a primitive, or should we implicitly, or should we be taking one and adding it to an iterator of others? I think Joe's solution of, oh, if it's an iterator, pop one off and you're done, is workable, but is that going to be unpleasant compared to using a primitive?
I mean, it is a little bit unpleasant in that your operation necessarily becomes partial at that point, right? Because you can't guarantee statically that the iterator has at least one element. Whereas if I passed, you know, if this were a static method or a primitive method, and I passed the entire, you know, I passed an iterator that had zero elements, I would expect to get my promise fulfilled, immediately with a zero element array.
Yep.
Yeah. Currently, that's how the implementation works.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in that, it doesn't give you a way to do. Yeah, it doesn't give you a way to do zero operation. But I guess more importantly, if you're given an iterator, it becomes necessarily a partial operation that you then have to come up with something to bail out for. I don't know.
Maybe the right solution is to do both, so that the method on a promise includes the promise, takes an iterator, and we also have a primitive that takes the iterator, pulls one, sets it up. If there isn't one, returns you a promise that will return you a zero element or fulfill on a zero element array right away. Is that dumb?
Yeah, I mean, if this were one of my libraries, this is where I would jump out to primitive promise util and start shoving my static methods on there.
Right.
And I know
I would
that
be tempted to call.
Don't like the util naming convention, but yeah.
Well, it's simply that I would be tempted to call it, have a primitive join with an apply method that took an
promise
iterator.
Join, like that.
Or just join.
Yeah.
It's in the promise library. If it conflicts with anything, you can slap a call site and a use site rather namespace on it. I don't know. That question of how much of a wart you should have on names in packages is still, I think, we don't really know yet.
Yeah, I mean, for something as generic as join, I would be tempted to say that, and especially when right now I think the only type being exposed is, well, let me look at it actually, yeah, for sure.
Well, it's promise, fulfill, reject, and I think something else.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So I guess I was thinking about it like promise was the only one, or that, yeah, if for one of my libraries, I would probably make it, you know, promise fulfill, promise reject, and but
right,
just because it's weird, you know, if you were to do use promise equals promise, then it's weird to have to use promise dot promise everywhere in your application.
That's true.
And that's why I would tend to at that point just, you know, prefix everything with the same prefix.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, I guess, you know, with the library as it stands now, join is, you know, just using straight up join is more consistent with the fulfill and reject, because those are also both very generic operations, right?
There's another approach to helper modules from functional languages, which is to use the plural. So promise would be the type, and then there would be some primitive promises that would have.
That's method. Exactly what I have in my comment.
Oh, you're way ahead of me. That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not personally a big fan of the plural thing, but it does have some, I guess, history, I guess you could say.
Yeah. I mean, the other approach is you allow non-generic types to exist in the same module as generic types with the same name. So this is how, for example, F# works, where you could have a promise primitive and then promise of a actor, which in their separate types, but they have exactly the same name. I must admit that makes me nervous.
Yeah, it makes me nervous too.
Okay.
If we were going to, you know, if we're going to make a change like that, I don't know. I'd still prefer to talk about having static methods over that sort of thing, but
yeah.
But I remember last time I brought up static methods, we were talking about, well, when do you actually want to use these? And here's an example. Because the one we were talking about last week, I guess, was like, are there any examples in which you want to use them that isn't just like a constructor that can error or return something else? That is, like we're talking about like the files package where you wanted to return a file or you wanted to return like some sort of error code.
I guess the thing that would make me uncomfortable is really this is a case of a constructor. It's a constructor concerned entirely with promise A, but returns something not exactly a promise A, but rather related to a promise A.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense that you would call promise A dot join on some iterator over promise A and get a promise array A out of that, right? What wouldn't make sense is if you had static method that somehow returned something that had nothing to do with A or nothing to do with promise. Right, you could start packing, and I know that part of that is you can't stop programmers from putting together idiotic code, right? And that's fine. I guess it's more that a static method doesn't give you modularity in the way a primitive does, in the sense that I can't hand you a different implementation with the same signature that you can use replaceably. Unless we treat unless we have some concept of promise A the module and promise A the type. Does that make any sense? Using module here to mean the equivalent of a primitive, but because I don't know if you guys know, but a primitive is totally a parameterized module from the functional world.
That's how I've been using it.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been slightly tempted to rename the module, but, you know, pretending to object-oriented programmers that they're singleton types and everything's fine here and you don't have to be worried is very convenient.
So, anyway. Sorry, I missed it. What are you proposing you would do to accommodate that sort of use case?
Basically, the problem is that a static method could only be invoked like a constructor.
Uh-huh.
Right? You couldn't have static methods that form modules where a module is a first class value. Right? A module in Pony is a first class value. Pass one around. In fact, they can be, you know, structurally typed. It's kind of cool. It's something that some functional languages have struggled with, and for Pony it's built in, which is nice. But static methods on a type break that. All of a sudden, they're no longer first class. You can't pass that type around as a first class value that can structurally fulfill some interface. This is very
programming
language theory and might be very annoying. I apologize.
No, I think it makes sense. And like you said, it works on a primitive because the primitive is just
it's an instance.
It's true that you can't pass a value of that is just like a type because we.
Would it mean to pass a promise A?
Right.
It would mean that effectively we're mixing the concept of a primitive and a type.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree that it's like I agree that's something we would not want to go further toward, but I don't necessarily think that it's a problem that you could only invoke it on a type. And I guess maybe the answer to your question is, you know, you're like, well, how do we pass something like that so that it could be you could invoke a static method on something you didn't know the concrete type of. Maybe the answer is that you would do it via a type parameter, and the type parameter would be constrained on some interface that includes, where the interface includes a static method, right? You would use a type parameter for passing that sort of thing around and not
so that it becomes a static value rather than a dynamic value. That works in some sense, but it's not assignable. So I can't have one and hand it off to some other call, if that makes sense, because it's not a first class value.
Right. Yeah. I mean, just I'm not certain that it needs to be. I don't know.
Yeah.
Because I mean, like you don't. We're not needing to call. I mean, you're right that a lot of the cases where you want to reach for a static method are when you want to do something that's kind of like a constructor, but not really.
Yeah.
On that type. And we also can't pass around a type for the purposes of calling a constructor on it, as a first class value, it could only be a type parameter, right?
Indeed. Yeah.
So it's already true of constructors. So the static, and it makes sense because, you know, a constructor is on a type, it's not a method on the object.
Right.
So I guess I'm not seeing the limitation that you're talking about. I'm not seeing it as being something sort of novel that's being introduced with this change. It's just sort of like static methods fall in sort of the same class as constructors, except for you control the return value.
Right.
But both of them have to be invoked on a type rather than invoking on a value.
Yeah. Very interesting. It kind of makes me want to take constructors off of types and say that you have to implement a constructor as a promise that can fully initialize a value. I'm sorry, as a primitive that can fully initialize a value. That's crazy, and I promise we won't ever do that. But it does make me want to go down that route. Because basically, your point is excellent, is what I'm trying to say. Okay, I think for right now, for this, I think doing both and having Funtag join that says join me with this iterator, but also have a promises.join seems like a good way to go.
Yeah, yeah. Or I mean, I'm fine with just having a primitive named join.
Okay.
If that is what we prefer. I mean, promises.join would at least give us a place to add more similar methods if we wanted to in the future.
Yeah. I think promises.join is good. It gives us the promises module to go with the promise type, and yeah, it's probably pretty good. I think I jump too quickly often to having primitives with just one apply method when that's not necessarily always the most helpful. Okay, cool. That was quite productive, actually. Number 79, RFC for bare lambdas. You said that you were going to write a few things up.
Haven't done it yet.
No. Okay, cool. Never mind then. I was hoping we could just merge this one because we're all super in favor of it. But I want to make some changes.
Yeah. I haven't had time. I've been pretty busy.
No worries. I just want to hit that merge button real bad. All right. Let's look at PRs. I don't think there's any. Oh, yes, there is. 1618.
Yeah, I was tempted to hit the merge button on this, but I wasn't sure whether Sean had any outstanding concerns with it or not. But I don't know that he does.
Yeah.
He hasn't really expressed any, just that, you know, I messed up and didn't put the description in the actual commit message.
Oops. No, I think this is clearly a fine change, and we should totally merge this. It did make me pause, though. And I feel a little bit like an idiot that I'm bringing this up now after Benoit did such a brilliant job on the original RFC and implementation of this. Did we get this backwards? Is the unsafe stuff actually what we should be doing by default?
Probably. I mean, I think the argument was in the original work that Benoit did laying it out was that going back to the pony principle and you know, saying that correctness is
right
above all else. Where with so, I think it does make sense that you're if you want to do a performance trade off and you understand the risks. And you recognize that that you can either deal with them or they don't apply to you, then you do the unsafe operation. So I don't think okay. We got it back in.
Okay, cool. Good to know. Okay, in that case, I shall squash and merge. Everyone okay with that?
Yeah.
All right.
I mean, do you agree? Do you still have concerns about getting it backwards?
My concerns are entirely theoretical at this point, which is, and I think if we get to the point where we keep going back to packages and going, oh man, we should have just used the unsafe stuff here for performance, then maybe we want to look at it. But I think that's a pretty reasonable thing to do now is leave it alone, and I'll just, you know, be slightly paranoid about it later.
Yeah.
I don't think there are any particular issues that are desperate for discussion. Does anyone have any that they feel are desperate for discussion at the moment?
There was one that, let's see, the Dippin's PR for the foreign types
pack. Oh, yeah. Oh, good point. We should talk about that one a little bit.
Yeah, I told him 2 weeks ago we discussed it on the next sync call and we didn't get to it. We ran out of time.
We should totally do it now.
Try to hit on it.
Yeah. Also, sorry about that, Dippin, given that you put a ton of work into this. Okay, so I was okay with this approach, but I'm also okay if you think we ought to do something different. I just want to note, by the way, that I think the way that Dippin wrote the per-type documentation is really cool. I hadn't really ever thought of just sticking it on the same darn line right next to it, and it looks really good. But anyway.
I think I suggested that to him. I've been using that in a couple of places, and it just sort of, like, for short things, it kind of makes sense.
It's really cool. I really like it. Anyway, yeah. So what are the options that make you comfortable with this at the moment, Joe?
Okay. Well, my this kind of comes down to I proposed something that I think would make me comfortable and not also and also not require any changes to the language.
Okay.
Because we
the platform
talked stuff. About the implications of those kinds of changes.
Yeah.
And Dippin had some remaining concerns about it. My suggestion is that all the individual platforms become sub packages of foreign types, mm-hmm. so that basically the gist of it and why I think it is a good solution is that within an ifdef, if you're within ifdef Linux, then you use the Linux sub package. If you're within an ifdef OSX, you use the OSX sub-package. If you're in an ifdef POSIX, then you use the POSIX sub-package, which is the intersection of the things that are the same from the Linux and the OSX package.
Right. So are you thinking
anything that is accessible from within the package of the same name as the ifdef you are in should be correct and safe to use. And that's what I see as being valuable.
Oh, I see. So not in, okay. Sorry. I was confused. So you're not talking about automatically doing that. You're talking about, you can just look at the code and go, look, it's in the Linux branch and it's using an OSX def. That's crazy. Let's fix it.
Yeah. Basically that you would always like, it wouldn't be something that would be checked by the compiler, but you use the convention of assigning it to, if you go up, I think it's like,
yeah, I see.
1, 2, 3. I don't know if you can see my comment. It's several comments up. It says 11 days ago.
Yeah, I see it.
Yeah, with the idea being that it basically gives you it gives you a clear indication of which package should I be pulling from to get the type I need. And for example, if you're in an ifdef with a certain platform name and you go to that platform name and try to grab the type from it and it's not there, that tells you that, you know, that type is not defined on that platform.
Right.
And also for the case of like POSIX, I was suggesting that POSIX be like the intersection of all the sub platforms that we use as being part of the POSIX ifdef platform. We would use for the POSIX sub package, we would use the intersection of the types that are the same from all platforms that are considered to be in the POSIX platform, so that if you're in an ifdef POSIX, it's safe and correct to use any type under the POSIX sub-package.
I like
but
that.
But Dippin had some concerns with that being that conflating the concept of people would think that this means that the type is defined by the POSIX standard.
I'm not too worried about that part. No one in their right mind keeps track of which types are defined by the POSIX standard. I assume the people in their left mind who do keep track are saving us from ourselves, but oh well. I'm not too worried about that. I think this is a good way to go. And I like the idea of then of using platform types instead of farm types. This all makes sense to me now. And thanks for explaining. Let's do it that way. How's that?
Okay. Well, Divin did have some concerns brought up. Let's see. The 1, 2, 3, 4, 5th most recent comment. Is Divin outlining his concerns?
The long one.
Yeah. So let's see.
Well, Pidge should be removed from the because it really is more platform specific. It's POSIX does not define PID. I know it claims that it does, but it doesn't. All it says is that there is such a type, but it doesn't define it.
Right. Well, that's So that's where we get into a little bit of trouble. I had said that my solution to this was that, well, any platform that we support, we check the size of PID and we define it in its sub platform, we define it in the POSIX package, and if it's the same across all of those platforms we support, we define it in the POSIX package so that it is available from within an ifdef POSIX. So I guess the question then becomes, is it, should a user expect to be within an ifdef POSIX clause and use POSIX.pid?
Okay, so to my brain, clearly no, because there is no such thing as POSIX.pid. There's only PID on some specific more specific platform. However, I think this means that we should at least mention why we're not talking about ifdefing types. Because any sensible person listening to this conversation would say, why don't you just have platform-specific type definitions? So the reasoning behind this is that Pony type checks for all possible compilation targets, even if you're actually only code-genning for a specific compilation target. And that has been extraordinarily useful from day one of the Pony compiler to have a little bit of confidence about what platforms are being covered, and when you go and modify code that you haven't broken it for some platform, because it happens to type check on your platform, but it wouldn't type check somewhere else. Allowing ifdef types. So Andy McNeil wrote some quite intense code for doing this properly, particularly for FFI definitions. It's possible that we could extend that for ifdef types as well. And if someone wanted to look into that, it would be really neat if we could do it. But I would be, it's certainly a non-trivial amount of work, and I would really rather not give up type checking for all platforms. The contrary opinion on this is, hey, there aren't really that many different platforms. Why not just type check for the ones that you want to type check for? And isn't this CI's job, not the compiler's job, to make sure that this thing works on whatever collection of platforms your package wants to support? And that is the view taken by every single other language, and so probably shouldn't be discounted as dumb, because it's not. So those are some possible other positions to this that I just wanted to make sure that we covered. Does anyone have any strong feelings on any of that?
I mean, I think that I don't have strong feelings, but I think that the things you said that are useful about that are, you know, they are useful, and I think we should try to keep them if it continues to make sense. And really, this is this is one of the only places where we really want to have platform-specific types, right? In normal packages that aren't FFI-related, having platform-specific types is kind of crazy and stupid.
It seems like it. So far, we've done really well by having platform-specific FFI inside of a type, but having the type be actually the same across platforms. Admittedly, we do have a few that are magically platform-specific, like U-size. So that's a thing that exists. It's magic. But the way U-size is magic is kind of interesting in that all of the method calls on it are the same for everything in TypeCheck, exactly as you would expect for all platforms. It's not an alias for a type like it is in C, where you can get into trouble quite quickly because you, on a 32-bit platform, you happily assigned it to a 32-bit integer and you compile it and complain, and then later it does complain. I don't know if there's anything we could learn from that for these things. I don't know. And I really don't know how it combines with the possibility of using libclang to auto-generate structs from C headers.
The conversation gets a lot bigger at that point.
Where, gosh, you know, even the presence of a C header on a platform is... Dunno. So I think we ought to do it with the platform stuff that you're suggesting right now. Dippin's concerns, I think, are well-founded, but they are bigger than this in the sense of it comes back to some of that libclang stuff, I suspect, in the end.
And that's one of the issues here. I mean, he does have a valid concern that POSIX.PID is not guaranteed to be any specific size, and thus we can't really include it in the platform type POSIX package, other than under my, you know, sort of original proposal of just say that, well, if it happens to be the same across all platforms that we support, then it would be in that upper level package so that you could use it from there.
Yep.
But I mean, it comes down to, like you said, POSIX defines that PID exists and you should be able to use PID on a POSIX system. But you don't know what it is, except by looking it up in C headers. So,
And I mean,
you expect to be able to use POSIX.PID from within an ifdef POSIX block, right? Sort of naively speaking.
I actually would go either way on that one. I've had enough trouble with code that used POSIX types and ended up making bad assumptions. Not really. Not necessarily.
So you'd expect somebody to have to do an ifdef OSX, ifdef Linux, ifdef FreeBSD or whatever else we include in the POSIX platform, and have those all be the same code except for they're using OSX.PID and Linux.PID.
When the types differ. Yeah. I think that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess the question we're talking about is, like, are we doing this only when the types differ in reality, or only when they could hypothetically differ? Like,
only when they differ. I think only when they differ in reality.
Right. So that's what makes me say that PID should be defined in the POSIX package. If it doesn't differ in reality for any of the platforms.
Yep. Absolutely. If it doesn't differ in reality, totally slap it in the POSIX package.
Oh, okay. Well, okay. It seems like then you and I are in agreement and Dippin is not, but,
yeah. And okay. The thing is, from a purely practical point of view, I'm totally in agreement with you. From a gosh, boy, it would be nice to address these things. Dippin's absolutely right. It's not like he's wrong about any of this stuff.
Yeah, it's but, sort of like we're acting in a non-ideal situation.
Right. This is an endemic problem with C rather than actually a problem with Pony.
And we're trying to avoid adding a bunch of language-specific features for dealing right. with C problems. When
exactly.
Really, this is probably one of the only places where it's going to come up, right? Is in this platform type package, or you know, maybe some, maybe there will be some types that aren't in here that users run into that they need to do like this. But
yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And so I think let's just do it this way.
Okay.
We're over time, and actually I should probably get going, unfortunately. But, Joe, would you be willing to write up some of the commentary on this one?
Yeah. I think there's not much to write other than we agree. Yeah, anyway, yeah, I'll write something up. Yeah.
All right, cool. Basically, you're right, Dippin, but we're going to do the wrong thing anyway.
Yeah, and I guess just plan to revisit when we look at the libclang stuff.
Yeah.
Documenting it is useful.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, Kevin. All right. Cool. Yeah, I guess I better run out. Sorry about that. Thank you, everybody. And I thought this was a particularly productive call. So thanks, everyone. And see you next week.
Take care, everyone.